Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.
Welcome back to Voice of the Cape, Drive Time. 0722380712 is our WhatsApp line. Any questions, comments, you can address them there. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Facebook, we've got all of that. A Palestinian activist is in Cape Town, South Africa this week as part of the Israeli Apartheid Week, something that is commemorated right across the world. Palestinian-American journalist and author Ali Abonima has been engaging student leaders, community activists, and struggle veterans this week on Afro-Palestinian solidarity, which is the theme of this year's Israeli Apartheid Week. Ali Abonima lives in Chicago, and he is the co-founder of the widely acclaimed online publication, The Electronic Intifada. Just a commercial quickly, Ali Abonima will be speaking tonight at UCT 6:30 p.m. Tomorrow night, Palestine Museum in District 6 at 17:45. But Ali Abonima, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to Voice of the Cape Drive Time.
Alaikum assalam. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, it's very interesting. You find yourself in Cape Town, South Africa. Israeli Apartheid Week is the big issue at hand. But as a matter of interest, I was having a look before this interview on the internet, and there's certain people back in the U.S. who are claiming there's an Ali Abonima in South Africa who wants to destroy Israel. Just very quickly, what's your comment to that?
Well, the first thing is I've been traveling in South Africa meeting fantastic people, so I haven't paid any attention at all to what those kinds of trolls are saying on the internet. But that's not the first time I hear that, and I think it's a perfect analogy to what happened in South Africa when people demanded their rights and people demanded an end to apartheid. They were told, you're a bunch of terrorists and what you really want to do is to destroy South Africa. So what I call for is the end of Israeli apartheid and the liberation of the Palestinian people, and hopefully a future where nobody is subjected to oppression. They call that the destruction of Israel. Well, you know, if a state can only exist by denying the rights of millions of people, millions of indigenous people, then you have to really question what kind of state that is.
Absolutely. Now, just as a matter of interest, very quickly about you and your family, just to show to some of those trolls that Ali Abonima is not talking through his nose, your family, I've learned, was in Palestine since about 1492. So that is certainly a few centuries between drinks, isn't it?
Well, actually, I've seen that on the. That's a slight misunderstanding. There is a story in my mother's family that's when they came, but which was certainly quite a long time. But my father's family are really, you know, have been there even longer, as far as we know. They come from a village called Batir, which was recently recognized by UNESCO as a World Heritage Site for its unique system of terraces that dates back to Roman times, and which the people there have been looking after since then. So, of course, it's not a question of when you came, and certainly Palestinians are indigenous to Palestine. It's a question of what rights you have and how you're treated. Nobody deserves to be denied their basic rights, whether they came yesterday or whether they can trace their ancestry back hundreds or thousands of years. We don't consider that to be a reason to deny anyone their rights.
Now, obviously, I mean, I think everybody would agree with it. That's perfectly logical. The point that I was just trying to make is that there are some people who would argue that Palestinians themselves per se don't belong on the land because they didn't originally come from there. So that was just a reason for making that point, basically.
No, that's well understood, but it's very interesting because while being in South Africa and looking back, you know, one of the things I'll mention at the University of Cape Town this evening is that the kind of propaganda used to justify apartheid in South Africa is so similar to what the Israelis say. One of the things that the apartheid regime's defenders used to say is that actually, you know, we didn't displace any Africans or any black people. When we came here, when the settlers came to the Cape in 1652, it was an empty land, and it was the prosperity and development that Europeans brought that, you know, attracted Africans to come and, you know, enjoy the blessings of what white civilization had brought. And that's exactly what Zionists say in about Palestine. They say it was a land without a people, and therefore the Palestinians, they aren't a real people. They don't exist. Well, the fact is that millions of Palestinians today live under Israeli military occupation. Millions more live as refugees, denied their right to come home only because they're not Jewish. That's how Israel defines itself as a Jewish state. But what we also have to remember is that Zionism, Israel's state ideology, really claims to speak in the name of Jewish people, but it's not a legitimate claim to do so because most Jewish people don't live in Israel. And what we see, particularly in the United States, you may not see this from South Africa because probably all you see about the United States is Donald Trump these days, but there really is an upsurge, in a very interesting upsurge in America, of young Jewish people who absolutely reject what Israel is doing and who say this is not happening in our name. And it's really worrying the pro-Israel groups because they can no longer claim to speak with one voice and to say that we're legitimate in doing this. And that's also the message of Israeli Apartheid Week here in South Africa, that global solidarity plays a tremendous part in this liberation struggle. South Africa couldn't do it without global solidarity, and Palestine can't do it without global solidarity. That's why Palestinians are really counting on South Africans to raise their voices.
Now, it's interesting you've mentioned global solidarity because, yes, indeed, it is true. That's how the demise of apartheid was brought about with the boycotts and the trade embargoes, but basically brought the country to its knees economically, thus forcing political change. But looking at the whole solidarity landscape, would you agree that in the last couple of years, maybe slightly more, that as one goes to different countries, that people's awareness of what's really happening in Palestine is getting better? One has to contextualize less and less nowadays when one goes to various events around the world. Are you experiencing that?
Absolutely. I think what I'm experiencing is that people don't necessarily know all the intricate details, but they do understand that millions of Palestinians are being denied their most basic rights. They look at, for example, the case of Ahed Tamimi, the 17-year-old Palestinian girl whose picture has been in newspapers all over the world. What happened to her really tells the story of what's happening to so many Palestinian children. She lives in a village called Nabi Saleh, whose land has is being confiscated for Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And on December 15th, Israeli soldiers invaded the village, as they do almost every week, and she was filmed on video shoving and slapping two heavily armed Israeli soldiers. She's a 17-year-old girl. She represents no threat to these Israeli soldiers. It was, you could say, symbolic resistance to say, we don't want occupation soldiers here. Well, what happened is that this video went viral. In Israel, the press was so outraged. It's, how can we let a mere Palestinian humiliate our soldiers like this? So they came back a few days later in the middle of the night, arrested her from her home, and threw her in a military prison, and she's still there today. She is being subjected to a military trial and could face 10 years in prison for this. Now, here's the other thing that is so important about this story. Just moments before, or less than an hour before she was filmed shoving these soldiers, one of them had shot her 15-year-old cousin in the head. He survived by a miracle. And then they arrested him, too. And so this is the situation now, where you have more than 300 Palestinian children right now in Israeli military detention. I find that people around the world get that. They understand it. They know that there's something wrong. No normal country behaves this way. No democracy, as Israel claims to be, behaves this way. They get that there's something wrong and it needs to end.
Do you think the fact that probably for the first time in many years, people trying to understand what's happening in Palestine have actually got a face and an identifiable figure, and obviously a very vulnerable figure? Most Palestinians are extremely vulnerable in terms of Israeli aggression. But with Ahed Tamimi, it's actually personalized the whole situation. It's no longer just a Palestinian. It's Ahed Tamimi. Do you think that that's a very important dimension of what we're talking about?
I think it can help. Ahed Tamimi, you know, has become a symbol. She's become a place to rally, you know, people's support and mobilize support. But Ahed Tamimi and her family would be the first to say, and I know because they've said it, it's a very active and outspoken family, that this doesn't start and end with Ahed Tamimi, that the focus on Ahed Tamimi, yes, has to be about freeing her immediately, but it has to be about ending Israel's military detention, torture, and abuse of Palestinian children. And of course, that detention, torture, and abuse is part of this system of Israeli apartheid. And apartheid is the right word for it because, you know, just a year ago, there was a UN report that was published, very meticulous, that found beyond a reasonable doubt that Israel practices apartheid against the Palestinian people. And in January this year, the representative of South Africa, the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, said Israel is the only country in the world today that can be called an apartheid state. Well, if you say those words, that carries a big responsibility because apartheid is one of the most serious crimes against humanity in international law. And so if you identify Israel as an apartheid state, the question to ask is what obligation does that put on South Africa and on other countries to act to end it?
No, absolutely. And I mean, on this very show, people such as Archbishop Desmond Tutu, former minister in cabinet Ronnie Kasrils, Ibrahim, all prominent government officials and activists who visited Palestine, and many others who've been there from the anti-apartheid struggle in this country have come back, and they've said on air that what they've seen in Palestine reminds them graphically of what everybody went through in South Africa, but there's always a rider, and they say, but it's far worse.
I've heard them say that a number of times, and that is so sobering to hear because, you know, how bad does it have to be worse than apartheid? One of the most heinous and dehumanizing systems in the world, and yet you've got these figures who speak with such authority saying, no, actually what Israel is doing is worse than apartheid. And I'll tell you this, what makes it even more shocking is that Israel now is engaged in an intense propaganda campaign in Africa, including in South Africa, to try to discredit these veterans, these giants of the anti-apartheid struggle, when they say from their experience that what they saw in Palestine is worse than apartheid. And Israel is trying to spread the message that it is a friend of Africa. I saw that myself just a few days ago at Wits University in Johannesburg, where we saw these posters all over the campus put up by the Israeli government-funded group Stand With Us, saying how great Israel is, you know, how great its relationship is with Africa, when the reality is that Israel has for decades been supplying some of the most brutal regimes. Israel supplied weapons to Rwanda before the genocide, Israeli weapons for use during the genocide, to Burundi, to South Sudan, basically wherever you find a large-scale violence, civil war, and ethnic cleansing on this continent, you will find Israel's hand not far away. The other factor is that Israel is currently deporting 40,000 African refugees, targeting them. Just a few days ago, the UN Special Rapporteur on Racism and Xenophobia declared that Israel's campaign was racially targeting refugees from sub-Saharan Africa for deportation. At the same time, Israel is coming to different countries in Africa, including South Africa, and falsely marketing itself as a bringer of technologies, of irrigation, of green technologies, of energy, of water management, and it has to be understood for what it is, which is propaganda.
No, absolutely. In Cape Town, for example, we're going through a very bad drought, and we heard people saying, no, the Israeli water experts are coming, and when it was pointed out to them that these are the people who have basically drained the Dead Sea, it's two seas at the moment, two puddles, the Lake Tiberias or Sea of Galilee is draining rapidly, they've destroyed the West Bank aquifer, and they steal water from the Syrians. So it's amazing, isn't it, how this propaganda is presented, but if you push past its very thin veneer, the opposite is always true.
Yes, you know, Israeli water experts are experts at stealing water from Palestinians. That's what they're expert at. And I'll give you solid examples here. I mean, there was a study a few years ago by the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem that they published that found that the average water consumption for Palestinians in the West Bank was a few years ago, 73 liters. It's probably a bit less now. That's every day. That's not a drought. That's normal conditions. In some areas of the West Bank, in the northern West Bank, it's 44 liters. That's less than you get in Cape Town.
Absolutely.
Meanwhile, Israeli settlers, in fact, Israelis on average, are using more than 250 liters per day. So that's the Israeli water expertise. It's not water expertise, it's water apartheid. And how is it carried out? By the theft of the water resources. Palestinians are not allowed to dig wells on their own land. They're not even allowed to collect rainwater. Israel has a habit, if Palestinians erect cisterns to collect rainwater, the army comes and destroys them. So Israel not only claims the land of Palestinians, it claims the water under the land, and it claims the clouds in the sky as well.
Yeah, I think that's a very good analogy, because, well, actually it's a surreal truth, and surrealism in fact just can't get more surreal. Another big question, and I know that you deal with it every single time you do an interview, we hear politicians trotting out to try and shut us journalists up when we ask them about the situation. Oh, no, I believe in the two-state solution. But when you ask them about the dynamics of it, they start stuttering, going red in the face, and are unable to answer our questions. In your view, in terms of a political solution, what is the most constructive way forward?
Well, You know, a few years ago, an Israeli prime minister, Ehud Barak, was asked what the two-state solution is, and he said, it's us over here and them over there. What's the Afrikaans word for that?
Exactly. Yeah, we call it apartheid, don't we?
Exactly. And that's what they mean by a two-state solution. It means us over here and them over there. But them over there in conditions far inferior to those of us over here. And so I think inevitably, if we're moving towards an end to Israeli apartheid, and I hope it will be very, very soon, we're struggling for it to be very soon, then we will see equality throughout the land, the reunification of the country, not chopped up into different pieces, Gaza over here, the West Bank there, but a reintegration of the whole territory and a reintegration of all the people who live there under conditions of equality. Honestly, what other future can there be?
Yeah, I mean, logically, philosophically, it's impossible. You cannot argue against that. Because it makes sense that people should be able to live together under a constitutional dispensation which guarantees everybody has rights to be human in the land of their birth. I think it's as simple as that, isn't it?
I think it is. And, you hear these people who tell me, because, you know, I've been talking about the one-state solution for many years, and they'll say, oh, but Israelis will never accept it. You know, of course, people with immense power never easily accept to give it up. But on the other hand, I think it would be racist to suggest that Israelis are so fundamentally different from anyone else that they couldn't eventually come round to the idea of democracy. I think Israelis are just like anyone else, and eventually they can and they will. But it's not going to happen unless the price of the status quo is raised. If they're just left to their own devices and they can carry on the way they are, why should they change anything? And that's the critical importance of the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, because this is a nonviolent way to say to Israel that there is a price for oppressing the Palestinians. There is a price for denying millions of people their most basic rights. And if you want the pressure to end, the isolation to end, then there is a way out, but you have to be willing to take it. So that's, I think, the formula to get us there, is to raise the price of the status quo through boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
Do you find it significant that in Israel we've been hearing of legislation against BDS? You can't even kind of mention the word. It becomes against the law. The very fact that they are discussing it at that level, is it telling us that the BDS campaign is biting them in the backside, that it is actually hurting and it is making a difference?
Well, they say it is, and they say it is in a number of ways. The Israeli government, number one, they're putting their money where their mouth is. So the Israeli government has allocated tens of millions of dollars to try to fight against the global BDS movement. The other thing we know, my publication, The Electronic Intifada, last year we published a leaked report that was endorsed by the Israeli government and written by two well-known pro-Israel groups, but it was circulated only internally. We got a copy, and what it said, among other really heartening things for the Palestinians, is that the biggest impact of the BDS movement is what they called the silent boycott. The fact that people, organizations, companies all over the world, they are getting the message and they are refusing to do business with apartheid Israel, but they're not necessarily shouting about it. They're getting the message and they're staying away from Israel. And so they're saying, in a sense, that the impact of BDS is actually far greater than what is visible. That the visible victories where someone, boycotts Israel and makes a political statement is really only the tip of the iceberg. And that's particularly true with the academic boycott of Israeli institutions. Remember, Israeli universities are complicit in the apartheid system. They're complicit through arms research. They're complicit through subsidizing soldiers, for example, who took part in the 2014 massacre on Gaza. And I want to commend TUT, the Tshwane University of Technology, which in December announced that it would refrain from any institutional ties or agreements with Israeli universities until until Palestinian rights are respected. And that's an example of an institution in South Africa taking a moral stance that has the potential to really show global leadership. And so Palestinians are hoping for much more, particularly from South Africa, because of its unique moral authority to speak on apartheid.
Ali, let's get quickly back to the theme of this year's Israeli Apartheid Week, Afro-Palestinian solidarity. As you travel the length and the breadth of South Africa, do you find that most South Africans, particularly South Africans who were on the other side of the apartheid fence, have an instinctive understanding and empathy with all the things that you talk about?
I do. But at the same time, we can't take that for granted because, memories fade. It's already been a generation since the end of apartheid in South Africa, which means that it's very important for South Africans themselves to remember, relate their history as their history and not let someone else write their history for them. Which is a topic that has come up in my travels, that the rest of the world is trying to, in a sense, paint a much sort of rosier picture that erases the price of the struggle that people paid in South Africa. That's one thing. The other is that there has to be ongoing grassroots work, and I have to say I've been so impressed and inspired and moved by the young people mobilizing for Palestine. Their solidarity means the world to people in Palestine. But they're doing really hard work, and that's what is helping to win victories. For example, South Africa's decision, the ANC's decision, to downgrade ties with South Africa came about because of this kind of grassroots work. And I think it's the same grassroots pressure that we'll actually see it implemented. It hasn't been implemented yet. So it's going to take lots of political work, but it's very heartening to see so many people committed to that in South Africa.
If one also looks at other aspects of Afro-Palestinian solidarity, we spoke about the fact that Israel has been extremely aggressive in Africa in terms of wanting to hold various summits. In fact, the one summit that Netanyahu wanted to hold never happened. And, of course, the arms industry infiltrating into Africa. What is your advice to African countries? Because some of them are very poor, and they could fall for the bait that Israel, or the worm that Israel is going to sort of dangle into their country.
Well, remember that this so-called aid comes with strings attached. And a stark example of that was in December 2016 when Senegal was on the UN Security Council and voted in favor of the UN resolution rightly condemning Israel's settlements on stolen Palestinian land. And what did Israel do the next day? It announced, we're pulling out our irrigation project, we're ending it. So is it truly aid? Is it truly, supporting development when it comes with political strings attached like that? The other thing is that often we've seen that aid projects, or so-called aid projects, are a cover for military cooperation. We've seen in Togo, for example, Israeli weapons traders going in and just claim that, oh, what we're doing is entirely humanitarian. So you have to be careful and really research what's behind these things. And I think that the other element is with the summit, which was supposed to be in Togo, that was cancelled. From my understanding, that was partly because South Africa played a role in pushing back against this Israeli charm offensive. So that's something that South Africans can be very proud of. But again, it's something that has to be constant and it has to be escalated. Palestinians have been struggling for liberation for more than 70 years. I think one of the things that makes me sad being in South Africa is that an entire generation has grown up in South Africa since apartheid, since the end of apartheid. Doesn't mean everything is rosy and perfect in South Africa, but that is still an incredible fact. An entire generation born free. And in that same period, an entire generation of Palestinians like Ahed Tamimi and so many others have continued to live in bondage. And I just want my next visit to South Africa not to be for another Israeli apartheid week. Let's not get used to doing Israeli apartheid week. I want my next visit to be to celebrate Palestine's liberation here in South Africa.
Ali Abunima, who is well known as a founder, co-founder of the widely acclaimed online publication, the Electronic Intifada. He is in South Africa for Israeli Apartheid Week. Its theme is Afro-Palestinian Solidarity. Ali Abunima will be talking at UCT this evening at 6:30 p.m. He will be tomorrow evening at the Palestine Museum in District 6 at 17:45, quarter to 6. Ali Abunima, everything of the best for your South African visit, and good luck.
Thank you so much, Shafiq.